Hello, welcome to the Above Average Irrelevance podcast. Today is Wednesday, March 16th. I'm Matt Weaver, and I'm here with Scott Nelson. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning.
How are you?
I am just fine. How about you?
I'm doing pretty good. It's colder today than it was previously, but it's still going to be almost 50 degrees in March today, so...
It's a blustery day. I do not like wind.
You know, you live in the Midwest,
for several reasons.
Right?
I know. Because my hair is always blowing all over the place, and I always have so much junk in my car, and then you open the doors, and all the receipts and paper and everything starts blowing.
I feel like there's a solution to that problem.
You weren't looking out to see me chasing down an ATM receipt on your front lawn before I came in.
So, this unusual weather pattern continues, which is okay.
Keeping it interesting.
Yeah. So let's get started. So first, we were just chatting before we started this. I know we were going to start with a Fitbit. We're going to wait. So you told a friend not to buy an iPhone, to wait for the small one. That's supposedly coming in a week. And now you're a little worried.
I'm nervous.
You've made a prediction.
Right. I'm nervous that I'm going to be wrong because I had someone who I was just with this weekend was going to buy an iPhone 6, even though she wants the, 4-inch or 4.5, whatever it is, phone.
4.7, I think, is the small one, right?
Okay. And I said, no, wait. Just give it 2 more weeks, and you might have your perfect next phone.
So I think there's a lot of pent-up demand for this smaller phone. I really do. I think a lot of people who have either an old phone, I have friends with iPhone 4s and 4s, right? But with the 4s or the 5s, or even a bunch of people with the 6 or 6s, I think they would prefer a smaller phone. My girlfriend has a 6S, and while she likes it, she kind of constantly complains that it's too big to fit in any of her pockets. It's a bizarre concept for most men to understand, but most women's pockets, if their clothes have pockets, are not particularly big.
Right. And so they're not particularly deep tends to be the problem.
Yeah.
That was this friend's kind of concern, is most of her pockets, like her current phone, is at the top of the pocket line.
Right.
So anything taller than that, and it would be sticking up, like jamming into your waistline.
Right.
So.
So
that does. Several people I have known who didn't want to get a bigger phone but bit the bullet and did it, like it, and don't want to go back. So I'm sure that's the experience for a lot of people who were nervous about a bigger phone.
Right.
I guess I don't know as many people who are disappointed with the larger phone, but...
The small, medium, big...
Choice is always better.
Choices in the phone size seems ideal. I've seen a lot of commentary on the internet about, the iPhone 5 case design was my favorite and the best case design ever. These people are on crack, because that is totally false. But I recognize that many people preferred that smaller 4-inch size. I thought that phone was too square. And I again go back to my favorite iPhone ever was the 3GS with the curved back. That was made of plastic, so it was very grippy, and it fit in my hand very well. I don't know why we've gone away from the curved phones. These, the 6 and the 6S have the curved sides, but they have the flat back. It feels like we could have gotten rid of the stupid camera bump with a curved back, but Johnny Ive and his... trapped in his white box, chose not to.
Yeah, I guess, I don't know. A lot of Android phones do have that convex back case, and they feel pretty nice in your hand.
Yes.
So I don't know what the...
Hopefully the 7 will move to an advanced case design that...
Maybe it has to do with, like, machining the aluminum and the volume they do it at for the iPhone. I don't know.
I feel like Apple does, you know, views process challenges like that as its, you know, purpose for being.
So the 21st, right, next Monday is the event. So I will find out by next week if I have led... If I have led anyone astray, telling them to wait for the new SE.
You know, there's kind of a... When you step back from it, I don't want to pull a Donald Trump and say I just thought of that. But I just thought of this. You know, if they have this small phone introduction, which comes 6 months later, that has a... It has an interesting effect on their, both their manufacturing needs and the quarterly revenue numbers, right? Because the
iPhone mid-cycle phone now.
Yeah, the iPhone sales make the largest component of Apple's revenue numbers, and they're often front-loaded, right? There's this, they come out, the quarter they come out, they sell, you know, a bajillion of them. And then the next quarter, they sell almost a bajillion, and then it kind of ramps down until you get to the end of the cycle, and then it starts all over again. So if this phone has what is rumored to be effectively the same innards, the A9 chip inside of it in the smaller form factor, that has the benefit of creating additional demand from their suppliers halfway through the cycle, which is better for the Apple suppliers and better for Apple. And they get another big shot of, hey, there's a new Apple phone, even if it's not as interesting, perhaps, as an iPhone 7 might be. Still, everybody is going to talk about a new Apple phone. At least a little bit. And there'll be a whole nother blast for accessory makers and the, you know, Verizon and AT&T and everybody will get another chance to get people into their stores and upgrade their phone and buy more data and do everything else. I don't know that Apple would make such a spreadsheet-driven move, but it might influence the timing of when the phone comes out. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. It seems like it will alleviate a little confusion. I mean, if the iPhone 7 launch had 3 different models, I think, you know, I mean, there weren't... The first time there were 2 models was with the 6, right? The 6 and the 6 Plus.
Well, did they introduce the 5C concurrent with the 5S?
5S, maybe they did.
Yeah. Which was, that was a confused and muddled message, right? Which phone should I buy again?
Right.
So that was hard.
So especially if, like, I mean, I'm assuming that the form factor of the, or the design of the SE, it's going to be similar to the 6 design, not the 7 design. So maybe that's it.
People are saying it's going to be similar to the 5, the iPhone 5 and 5S design.
That would be reasoning to deliver it off-cycle, so you don't have the 5C, 5S debacle again, where you have 2 very different-looking phones on stage at the same time.
Could be.
I don't know.
I don't know. It's a mystery. All right.
We will see.
Let's talk about my Fitbit.
So you got it.
I got it. My first day wearing it was yesterday. So I got the Fitbit Zip, which is the tiny little one that runs off a coin cell battery, right? A little,
okay.
Like you might put in a watch, right?
And you haven't lost it yet, and you haven't run it through the washing machine yet.
Correct.
Okay.
I'm also not used to wearing it. So yesterday I went to the gym and I changed into my gym clothes and I left my Fitbit connected to my jeans in the locker. And then I went and did, you know, 30 minutes of strength training and 31 minutes on the treadmill and then went back to my locker. And I'm like, oh,
you're filled with regret.
I totally didn't get credit for that, which is not
so
true.
Did you do it all? Did you do it all again?
No, I was tired, but I almost instantly had that that sense of I don't know if regret is the right word, but the sense that I did not get
what was coming to you,
the thing that I was supposed to get for doing it. Even though you still get it, right? The reason you work out is for the losing of the weight and the improvement in your mood and all of that other stuff, right? I'm going to get all of those things. I'm just not going to get some arbitrary number that this little tiny device gives me. But I had dinner with a friend last night who also has a Fitbit. He wears the one that goes around your wrist, you know, and monitors your heart rate and stuff. And so we added each other to our friends list, right? And so now I can see in the Fitbit app, right, for the last 7 days, his, you know, average step count is 130,000 or something like that, right? You know what I'm talking about?
Yep.
Right? And mine is, because I didn't wear it at the gym yesterday, like 2,000. And this bothers me. I don't know why it bothers me, but it bothers me. So, so far, so good. So this device has the sensor in it to determine, you know, when you step, right? And the instructions talk about it having a touch screen. But then it says, this touch screen isn't like other touch screens. You gotta
tap it
really hard,
yeah,
in order for it to register. It's like, I don't know why they feel compelled to lie and say it's a touch screen. It's not a touch screen.
No.
You're just triggering the sensor that they have in there. And in fact, when you do it, it gives you a step. So, I don't know. Maybe they feel that's an easier way to describe it, but I don't know why you would confuse your customers by saying it's a touchscreen. It's just not like any touchscreen everywhere else in your life.
It is an interesting sensor, though, because if I recall, like if you were to lay your finger on it very gently and press, I don't think it reacts. Like it has to be the tap.
Yes. Because it's just using that sensor that determines when you take
right.
a step.
Right, so it's using an accelerometer and... But it has to be using the touch too, right? Because it doesn't cycle through the menu just stepping.
It might. I don't know. I'm not watching.
It doesn't.
But
like if you held it in your hand and walked, it doesn't. So I think it's the combination. I think it is a touchscreen in that it's the combination of the touch and the jerk that's causing it to change.
They might be able to tell the... Maybe there's a different resonance frequency to when you're tapping it. As opposed to when you're walking. I don't know.
That one has like cryptic little faces and stuff on it too, doesn't it? Have some weird pixelated graphic, like a smiley and a frowny and...
Yeah, there's a smiley face, which if I can get it to show. And I think...
Well, if you haven't been walking, then you won't have it.
Yeah, I think the smiley face is supposed to... Like, right now, it's sticking its tongue out at me. I think the smiley face is supposed to be some, yay, you've walked a lot,
right,
or not.
Yeah.
It's not explained.
No, it's kind of cryptic.
The whole thing is cryptic.
My mom had one of those, and there was a long kind of period of figuring out what the heck that stuff means. I don't know if she ever really... I mean, it doesn't matter. It doesn't affect anything. It's just kind of fun, and you're, like, not in on the fun if you don't understand what the heck.
Yeah. There's a... The Fitbit app has a... Would you like to turn the smiley face off, right? A way to customize the display. And I've thought about it, but I thought, no. Give it a couple weeks and see if you like it. But.
So I think you can correct when you've missed activities. Have you done that? Like, you can go in and enter, Like, you can enter a cardio activity or a walking activity, and it will give you the equivalent steps. They have, like, a database or calculation of, you know, how many steps you get for a particular activity type.
Oh, interesting. I haven't found that in the app. Maybe you might dig around in there some more.
The last time I used the Fitbit, you couldn't do it in the app. You had to do it in the website.
So that it almost doesn't exist.
No. Because the app was just like data display and toggling a few settings. So and the website, you can do all kinds of entry stuff.
So clearly it Bluetooth syncs with the phone, which is what you would expect. But it came with this little USB dongle. They don't say that it's a Bluetooth dongle, but it's clearly this little tiny Bluetooth dongle so that your Fitbit can talk to your computer. And you can tell that I live in a bubble because I was opening the package and I, you know, realized what this was, and I was very confused. Like, why on earth would they feel compelled to give me a Bluetooth dongle? Like, who has a computer that doesn't have Bluetooth? Like, Apple's been shipping Bluetooth on computers for, you know, 7 or 8 years. And I thought, wait.
Yeah, desktop Windows computers do not.
That's right. The cheap $300, you know, Windows laptops don't have it.
Nope.
Which, yeah. You know, my bubble includes mostly people who have Macs or people who buy expensive Windows computers. And so it took me a moment to realize that the rest of the world does not live my privileged lifestyle. Yeah. So that's why that stupid thing is in there.
So you have it paired with the apps or with your phone, so you don't have to use the dongle,
no.
Right? So that's for people who don't have a smartphone.
Again, I'm all about being inclusive, but what the hell?
So it's interesting, and they might have changed this, but at the time I was wearing a Fitbit, that dongle would sync any Fitbit that got within, you know, the range. So like at work, when I would walk by somebody else's computer who had the dongle plugged in,
it would sync.
Mine would sync. Not with theirs. I mean, it would sync with my account. But like if I forgot my phone at home.
Oh, it would just use that dongle as a conduit to the internet to sync with.
Yes. You. All it is submitting, you know, here's the ID of the Fitbit, log it.
Yep.
Nah. So it's not paired.
Right.
Which is interesting.
I mean, this is like, paired, right?
So essentially there's like this mesh network. They could do that with phones. Well,
no, it's paired
can do
with
the
phones
because it has to be paired, right?
Right. I mean, it displayed a 4-digit code and I had to type it in and yada, yada, yada. So I suppose maybe that would be more interesting if you lived in a household with multiple Fitbits. But then, like, I would not use the dongle, right? I would attempt to just do the Bluetooth thing with the built-in Bluetooth on the computer. And that's, you know, Apple is stingy with their USB ports, so plugging in some permanently attached dongle into a USB port is antithetical to the Macintosh experience.
Right.
But anyway, I have it. So far, so good.
All right.
Do you... You have a Fitbit account, but you are not using it anymore.
No, I mean, I stopped using it when I got the Pebble. And now I've switched to the Vivo Active, but that's what I do my step counting with.
So I can't challenge you for the number of...
No, because nobody plays nicely with each other.
Man, that's so frustrating.
Yeah, there should be like a universal step count challenge sort of thing. It doesn't matter what device you're using. You can plug into the network.
Yeah.
But
maybe Under Armour, you know, because they've been gobbling up all of these fitness apps. Maybe they will eventually solve that problem because they are trying to make their apps work with everything under the sun. So maybe.
Maybe. I was long disappointed with Fitbit's software. As, you know, they kind of were rising to the market leader in step count, you know, wearable device. I feel like they have not made a lot of movement in their web app and their mobile app.
Well, so it looks nice, and if you're going to live just inside the Fitbit world, it appears to play nicely, but they're not interested in coexisting with anybody else. I wonder if somebody would buy them. Would Apple or Google or Microsoft come along and buy them?
I don't know. I mean, I think there was a falling out between them and Apple. Like, you used to be able to buy Fitbit products in Apple stores, and that is not the case anymore.
Well, it doesn't really play nice in the Apple ecosystem.
No, it was around the time that Apple introduced Apple Health, and Fitbit decided not to support Apple Health.
Right.
I think that's when they got a shove to the door of the Apple stores. So it might have seemed like at one time Apple would be interested in Fitbit, but...
They still might be. Who knows? Huh. Yeah. Well, speaking of Apple, I saw the other day Beta 7 for El Capitan .4 and iOS 9.3 was seeded. 7 betas so far. I mean...
Is that better quality control? Is that the deal?
I don't know. I mean, it's so... Having been a longtime Apple user, I'm kind of standing here going, man, 7. You know, I'm having one of these Steve Jobs would have never moments, right? I don't know if it's good or bad. 7.
Do you think it's directly related to the hubbub here a couple months ago about Apple software quality? We're going to beta the crap out of this, you know?
Well, I mean, their argument was, we release a beta, we get, you know, a hojillion people to use it, and, you know, things crash, and the data comes back to us, and we're like, oh, yeah, we were dumb, and they fix it. And I totally get that, and it totally makes sense. But I wonder, is there going to be some sort of beta fatigue by the people who are in the beta program? 7 betas. I don't know. Maybe there is some weird, nasty bug that they're working out in the corner of iOS somewhere. I don't know. Maybe they're finally going to fix your contact syncing across iCloud. I don't know what they're working on, right? but it struck me when I saw that the 7th one was released that it seemed like a lot more than I feel like they've ever done in the past. And I wondered if there's some negative implications of that.
Do you ever install the betas? Are you interested in that?
No.
I never have. I probably never will. I don't get any sort of thrill over... I mean, I know the people who do it, it's not because there's some great new feature they want in the beta. They're just doing it because they get a thrill out of running the latest and greatest.
Yeah. I used to work with a bunch of people that... You know, they in the middle of their workday, right, some major Apple operating system update would drop. They would stop what they're doing. And it's like, did you even put your code on GitHub? No. This will be fine. It's like, you could have waited till the end of the day and then messed with it. Not when you're trying to do work, right? And sometimes, you know, the company would literally pause for 4 hours while everybody installed the latest version, and then we discovered, oh, that thing was totally broken, and, you know, I don't know. Maybe I'm just old and curmudgeon-y, and I don't feel compelled to cause myself that much consternation.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate the people who do.
Yeah, absolutely.
That culture on the internet of giving back, you know, of sharing your time and talent and expertise is great. I'm more of a taker when it comes to the internet.
This is how we're giving back.
Right.
Our lovely commentary on the fools who install the newest code.
It's great the people who did it, but I'm not installing 7 iterations of beta of an operating system. I mean...
Now, to be fair... El Capitan, which I'm not running on any of my Macs, the fact that they're about to get to 10.11.4 means that it's about time for me to start thinking about installing that on one machine just to give it a test whirl.
Sure.
And be ready to go. Because I usually, you know, I typically install Mac OS when it gets close to the end of its development cycle, just before the next one comes out. So I'm trailing, you know, by about 8 or 9 months to whatever the newest is going to be. And that's just learned behavior over the years of letting Apple fix it a bunch before you install it. I'm more up to date on iOS. Like when iOS 9.3 comes out, I won't install it the day it comes out, but after a week or two, I'll probably install it. And a lot of that has to do too with you see this huge wave of app updates that say, mm-hmm. finally support this thing on 9.3 and whatever yep. else, right? So I kind of wait for, you know, the internet to catch up.
Right. I think that's a good plan. I would immediately install any iOS update just because I think it's fun and there's usually something new and interesting in an iOS update. Then I got burned when I did it. I talked about this.
Oh, with before. The iOS 8 updates?
I can't remember. It's the one that changed a bunch of stuff in Apple Music. And then I lost all my downloaded music, and I had updated like right before I left for like a long weekend.
That's right.
So I did kind of learn my lesson, but maybe that's more of a don't update your phone right before you leave on vacation thing too.
Probably. Right? Yeah.
So I got burned, and now I give it a few days.
I mean, Apple's track record of updates for iOS has been pretty good. I don't want to lead people astray and think that it's not the right thing to do.
I feel like I do remember more than once, at least a couple times, though, there have been news stories where something major has broken the first day of some upgrade. Like people can't get on the carrier network anymore, kind of like bad things.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that stuff happens. But, I mean, it's, you know, you don't have to take the one-year trailing macOS update strategy that I take. You can right. literally wait, you know, probably 3 days is enough.
Right.
To let the internet decide, is this iOS update brilliant or not?
Okay.
You know.
I'm with you. 3 days.
Yeah. So, all right. So let's just keep talking about Apple while we're talking about it. So somebody emailed Tim Cook and said, hey, what about, you know, force quitting apps on my iOS device? Does that save the battery? Of course, it got a response from, not from Tim Cook, of course, but from
Federici.
Yeah, from Craig, right? Yeah. Who basically said, no, 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 no.
Yeah.
and obviously, he's right. I do not close apps for the purpose of saving battery life. Sometimes I have a misbehaving app that loses its mind and you have to force quit it to restart it. I sometimes force quit apps because I'm trying to use two apps at the same time, and sometimes iOS doesn't seem to choose the right things to throw out. And as I'm switching back and forth between them, it's constantly reloading one of the apps, right? Like you're waiting for it to initialize again because the iOS hasn't kept it in memory or whatever. And so then I'll sometimes I'll throw away, you know, the five or six most recent other things that might be resonant in memory just because I'm trying to switch between two apps and I want them both to be left resonant in memory. Now, I do have an iPad 3, which is ancient in iOS land, which it still runs iOS 9, right? It's still a fine machine. It's just, you know, the universe has accelerated away from it. It was the first iPad to have 1 gig of RAM. But I'll tell you, it's slow. And so I often force quit things in there, not to save battery life, but just to choose effectively when I spend the several seconds it takes for it to change things, right? Like if I've been in there using Mail and Safari, and then I close that down and I go back and I launch Netflix, Netflix will run for however many seconds it runs for until iOS shoots it in the head and says, you didn't start fast enough, right? And I believe that's because Netflix is requesting quite a lot of memory And iOS is spending a bunch of time shutting down Mail and Safari and all that other stuff.
Get it.
And it doesn't get done in time.
Mm-hmm.
If I force quit everything that the iPad is running before I launch Netflix, the odds that Netflix will launch and run and behave just as you would expect it to is almost guaranteed. But if I have a bunch of other stuff running because I was using that stuff, it almost never works. So
I mean, that's a legit argument about what he's saying here, because you actually are having to manage the memory yourself.
Not really. I mean, if I were to launch it and Netflix
to not launch,
yeah, but
because
if,
it can't handle managing the memory fast enough.
Well, but
that's a problem.
But when I launch Netflix a second time, it works fine. It's just that I know too much about computer science, okay, so I know what's going to happen.
So your first launch is you manually managing the memory, yeah. And then your second launch is getting into the application.
Right. So since I know enough about computer science, and I know what's going to happen anyway, I just do it.
Yeah, that iPad's about ready to fall off a cliff of non-support, I'm sure. And then it won't be a problem.
I mean, you know, the world is hinging on this 4-inch iPhone. I don't care. I want the next iPad. That's what I want next week.
So I see people doing this all the time, like in the line at Starbucks or whatever, you know, they go in and they close all their apps. And I'm always thinking, you know, you don't really have to do that. I've had this conversation with people before. And I mean, I've seen the APIs for how it works, how it manages the memory. When your app goes away, you have a very limited amount of time to save things off. And then you're in cold storage, you know, until you get woken back up for a check or something. So it's like, I understand how it's working and it's not in memory. Like, it, you know.
Yeah.
So you aren't saving anything. But I do kill them occasionally when something, like you said, when something's misbehaving. There are times where the only way to get something to work again, or something that, you know, a connection has timed out, the only way to get it to work is to force quit the app. And that's the only way to force quit the app. So,
right. There are legitimate reasons that you can do that stuff. For battery life is not one of them.
Right. And this article I read actually made the argument that you're spending battery life by killing the app, because then it brings it back in just to shut it down and make it go away.
It costs a lot more CPU cycles to throw it away than it does to just leave it alone.
Leave it.
Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know if I should feel superior to other people that I don't do that for an illegitimate reason, but, yeah. It's funny how these ingrained patterns get embedded in people and like hang around for a long time.
You know, I think a lot of that comes from Android users coming to iOS, because that's a real thing in Android, or at least it used to be. You know, I haven't had an Android phone for a couple of years. Task managers killing apps that are using all your memory and slowing down your phone and wasting battery life. And I mean, there was a whole set of applications called task managers that allowed you to kill processes and clear applications and stuff like that. I mean, iPhone, like iOS, you couldn't really do that from the beginning, right? Like the task switcher is a relatively recent development, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. The iOS 4 maybe kind of came into being. I don't know. I mean, iOS has been a multi-process, you know, Unix-based architecture since the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
How much of that has been surfaced and made visible to you has changed over the years.
So you used to not be able to tell even what was running. Like if I was using an app, I hit the home screen, I'm doing something else, I want to use the same app again, I hit its icon again, it's unbeknownst to me whether I'm relaunching something that was already running, you know, or whether it's starting fresh.
Yeah, you could tell based on it either launched really fast or it didn't.
Right.
I mean, old iPhone tests used to include, you know, rebooting the phone in between every app launch, you know, to make sure that you were launching apps cold. Right. So then there was the, like, I'm going to reboot the phone and then launch Mail and time how long that was, and then close Mail and then relaunch it again and time how long that was. Right. Fortunately, we've grown somewhat more sophisticated since then, so. But, yeah, you could tell. It just, it wasn't, controls to manipulate it weren't really surfaced to you. So.
Okay, so don't swipe your apps.
No. Just let it go.
Let it go.
Yes. It the transition to the future will be easier if you just accept your robot overlords.
Yeah.
last night... let me back up for a second. Are you a keyboard nerd? That's a no.
That's a no. I care about keyboards. I can't use just any old trashy keyboard.
Right.
But I'm not obsessive about it.
Okay. I guess I'm probably the same way, right? I have a very strong preference for a full-size keyboard. The rest of the universe seems to like this Apple laptop keyboard, which, I mean, it has full-size keys, but I like the all the bits off on the right, right? I like the number pad and the arrow keys and all that other stuff. I prefer a full-size keyboard. And I have a very strong preference for no wire. I really do not want the stupid USB wire, you know, maneuvering all over my desk and getting in the way.
What are you doing on your desk? Okay, this is something that I do have an opinion on. I don't understand the no wires thing.
What?
What are you doing on your desk that wire is getting in the way of?
Well,
you like racing Hot Wheel cars or something?
Yes, clearly I'm playing with Hot Wheels. No, there's just, there's the, you know, you got your drink sitting there and, you know, a pen and something to write on. And I'm always kind of moving the keyboard and the cable is never the right length. Like if the cable was somehow the appropriate length, that'd be fine. But the cable is always like,
it's always hanging over the back long. Too far, or yeah. It doesn't quite reach. Yeah.
No, it's a pain in the ass.
Okay. Right? I'll just accept it and move on. But that's a problem that I've never had, like needing a wireless keyboard.
I need it.
Okay.
I do not, my aforementioned, do not like the little permanently installed USB dongle.
Okay.
Hanging around.
So it's got to be Bluetooth.
My computers have Bluetooth. Friggin' use it. Okay. It was invented so that I could have wireless keyboards. The only people that have so far made a wireless Bluetooth keyboard that hasn't totally
extended
sucked.
Keyboard.
No. Just a keyboard at all that's Bluetooth that hasn't totally sucked has been Apple, right? Everybody else, in an attempt to save battery life, lets the thing go to sleep. And then, you know, you get up, you go get a drink, you come back 5 minutes later, you sit down, and it's asleep. And you type a little bit, and then it takes it 3 seconds for it to wake up, and then it goes again. That drives me crazy, right? It needs to be faster than that. So...
And so that's a keyboard that they ship with like an iMac, right?
Right.
Okay.
So Apple's keyboards do not do this, right? They're, they either don't sleep or they wake up from sleep so fast that I don't notice it, right? Apple's Bluetooth gear, even though it's not in a form factor I like, and I only find the keys merely acceptable, not fantastic, at least their Bluetooth behavior is what I would expect. And I have not yet found anybody else who's been able to fix that. But just last night, right, there's a company called Matias, which is in Canada, and they make keyboards. They've been an Apple keyboard maker for a long time, though their keyboards work with PCs too, of course. And I just happened across their webpage yesterday, and they are shipping what they call the aluminum wireless keyboard, but it's an Apple-looking full-size keyboard that's Bluetooth. No wire.
Did you order it?
No, it's sold out.
Okay, that's what I see. First production run sold out.
And so, you know, I know that I personally have emailed them before and said, what I want is a full-size Bluetooth keyboard. Please make one.
They listened.
Well, the response I got from them a couple years ago, last time I did this, was, I just don't know if anybody wants that or not, right? Everybody seems to like the little tiny keyboards. Well, I said, I have one of those tiny keyboards because that's what comes with my computer. Mm-hmm. I do not want it. I want the full-size keyboard. So the fact that they finally made one, and it looks pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
I think the space gray one has my name written all over it because...
Yeah, that looks cool.
It's
odd they don't really show what it's propped up on, you know? So, like, the Apple keyboard has the little...
Not the new ones. The new ones are a little triangle. Because
Because it doesn't have the AA battery in it.
No, anymore. It has a rechargeable battery, which these have as well.
Gotcha.
So I think it's the same sort of wedge shape.
Okay.
But I am encouraged by the fact that they've made some, and they're sold out. Like, that to me is a good sign.
Mm-hmm.
So when they come back in stock again...
You're going to do it?
Yeah, my $99.
What, $99? That seems like a reasonable price.
That's as much as Apple charges for their new wireless keyboard. So.
Cool.
So, yeah. Finally, a full-size Bluetooth keyboard that has a very good potential for not sucking.
So I have the full-size keyboard with that terrible wire.
Yeah, I have one of those.
But I like the keyboard. Though, interestingly, just yesterday... So I like having a number pad, and I touch type on the number pad. Like, mm-hmm. I spent some time as a bank teller. I'm actually pretty fast.
Fast
9-key touch typist. Okay, so if I'm tabulating a column of numbers or something, I use that. It's kind of problematic on the Apple keyboard because the plus sign is like a single depth key. And on a traditional, like, adding machine or calculator or even a Windows keyboard,
yep.
The plus sign is a double height key above the enter key.
I don't think I've ever noticed that.
If you've never used it. So there's a little too much reach on my pinky when I'm hitting the addition key. So I was doing my taxes yesterday, and I kept, like, messing it up. And then I was like, why don't you just... I mean, there's a standard for the size of those keypad keys, and they changed it with the Apple keyboard.
Are you going to have some repetitive stress injuries?
Maybe, from trying to, like, curl my pinky down to hit the teeny tiny plus key. I don't use it. I guess I don't use the number pad enough for it to really be a deal breaker. But, boy, if you want it and it's not there and you're punching in a credit card number even...
Yeah.
I mean, how long does it take to punch in a credit card number using the, you know, number row?
Long enough it's that I don't do it anymore.
Yeah.
I copy and paste it into one password, right?
Right.
So, yeah.
So I never really want to be without the number pad at a desktop.
Right.
In a desktop scenario.
I know that there are all those, like, separate Bluetooth number pads, but that just seems problematic to
me. That's too much trouble.
Yeah. Not what I want.
Okay, well, I hope it's everything you dream it can be when you get it in May.
Hopefully. Who knows? Maybe they'll do another run and they'll just instantly sell out again.
Yeah, you're going to have to keep an eye on it.
Yeah. So, anyway, it's very exciting.
Cool.
So the most important thing is I want this to go in the show notes so that I can... Remember that.
Remember it.
Yeah.
You know, have you ever used... There's services online that'll, like, monitor a web page for you, you know, and shoot you an email
when it
changes.
I've never used that.
So you could find a utility, I'm sure, to monitor this URL and, like, send you an email when it changes, which would be interesting. Then you could know the moment it was available again.
I suppose I could just pre-order it, but... I haven't seen anybody review it yet.
Yeah.
And so I have a lot of faith in Matthias to make a non-sucky Bluetooth keyboard. But it would be helpful to have somebody, even if it was, you know, some CNET editor that said, and it's a non-sucky Bluetooth keyboard. Okay, right. That's all I need to know.
Speaking of reviews, this could be a segment like reviews about reviews. Because now, after we had that conversation about it, now when I see bad behavior in reviews, like, now it comes to mind. And so I ran into one this week, and it's a classic. when someone reviews a product and says, I bought this as a gift for my nephew. I hope he likes it.
Who cares?
That is not a review of a product. It's like, by design, you haven't reviewed it because you bought it to give someone else.
Mm-hmm.
I see those all the time, especially clothing. When you buy clothing online, lots of times you'll see, I suppose it's somebody's mom or something, and they're like, bought this for my son, hope he likes it. Like,
yeah, those are not helpful.
Or when you're buying a present for someone, like you can't review the product if you didn't use it.
I do see, I see this a lot on L.L. Bean, but I see a lot of women reviewing some piece of men's clothing, and it's, but it is helpful. It's like, you know, oh, I bought this shirt for my husband and, you know, he works road construction in the summers and he really loves this. He wears it all the time and I've now had to buy three more. Right.
That's really helpful.
It's really sturdy and it really stands up and I, you know, I run this through the washing machine three times a week or whatever. Right. And it's very helpful. So they're not wearing it, but someone in their life is wearing it. And you can tell it's the... you know, I have to buy clothes for my husband or else he would leave the house naked sort of thing,
yep.
Right? And so we buy this. It works well. He likes it, right? Or I bought this thing. He wears it and hates it. It's horrible. So
that is useful.
Those are useful, but agreed. The I bought this as a gift. I hope they like it. Why are you even typing?
Right.
Why are you wasting your time and mine?
Okay, so my other one
ran into. And they'll give it like a 5-star review.
Oh, that's the thing. They're always like 5-star. It's like they're reviewing the act of them purchasing it, which they did successfully.
Yay!
My other one I hate, and I see this all the time, is, particularly for men's clothes, is someone will post, yeah, I'm 6'2", you know, 215 pounds, and it fits great. They don't say what size they bought.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's completely,
small. Yeah.
It's completely unhelpful. Did they buy a tall? Did they buy an XL? Did they buy a double X? Like, if you don't know, I mean, I always appreciate when someone will say, you know, this is my build. This is how it fits. You know, it fits relative to other clothing in this fashion.
Right.
But it doesn't help me if you don't tell me the size that you bought.
Yes. You were so close.
Just I see one, that all the time. Yeah,
one
exactly.
Piece of data away. It's almost... there almost needs like a request data button. Like you should be able to hit a button that says, man, this was almost helpful, right? What size did you buy, right? Like submit a question back to the reviewer. Because I'm sure that it doesn't even occur to them that they didn't say that, right? It's like when you're, you know, trying to correct somebody's grammar on the internet, you will inevitably have the wrong, use grammar incorrectly, right? Like these people that write this review, they know what they're trying to say and they just didn't say it.
Mm-hmm.
But in their mind, they said it. They don't even see that they didn't say it.
And that's one of those things. If the context of your review is like you're logged in and you've clicked a link from your purchasing history or something, you know, a site could indicate that. Like this individual bought this product, this color, this size. Maybe there's like a privacy issue in doing that. I don't know.
Maybe.
I mean, Amazon will say like verified purchaser, but they don't go as far as listing like the particular options that a customer bought.
Yeah, like they won't say you bought a large or that you bought the red one.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, that's interesting.
But they should.
Maybe. They should if you want.
Maybe
they certainly
shouldn't.
Know what you bought, right?
Huh. Okay, those are my reviews of reviews for this week.
Okay. All right, so let's talk about something completely different. This past weekend, I was traveling to Illinois, and the route we took went through Waterloo, Iowa, which is north of Cedar Rapids. It's kind of in the middle of nowhere. I mean, I suppose if you live in Iowa, it may not seem like it, but to the rest of the world, Nowheresville. And so Waterloo, Iowa used to be home to a large John Deere manufacturing plant. That has pretty much gone away, but there is a John Deere museum there. Now, you don't have to be the largest John Deere fan in the history of the universe to get some enjoyment out of this museum. It's $8 to get in, and they have some old John Deere engines, like stationary engines, when that was the thing that people were using on the farm, plus quite a lot of the different tractors that John Deere has made, you know, for agriculture throughout the years. And they're just there, right in front of you. I mean, little signs on them that ask you not to touch them, but you can walk right up to them and breathe on them, right? And make a, you know, drool on them if that's your thing. So the, it's kind of a, you know, if you have any interest in, even remote passing interest in anything mechanical, it's kind of a fascinating thing to see. My girlfriend, who cares not at all for agricultural equipment, had a good time wandering through the museum for 45 minutes. So, I don't know. It exists. I had a great time doing it, and I recommend anybody else who's going to find themselves in the vicinity of the John Deere Museum in Waterloo, Iowa, go and visit it. It's kind of cool.
Yeah, I would like to see that sometime. So I've been to, there's a couple different John Deere places in Moline, where they're, Moline, Illinois, where they're headquartered out of, in the Quad Cities. They have like a big, oh, kind of a museum type thing, a plaza or a pavilion, they call it, with a bunch of machines. And then the Harvester Works, where they make the combines, you can go and tour the factory and see how that all works and see the machinery and stuff. And I always think it's fascinating. Part of it is just the size of the machinery is fascinating.
Yeah.
Especially if you haven't been around farm equipment.
Yeah, they had
before.
They did have like a 2015 model tractor that you could walk up and sit in, you know, with a CD player and Sirius XM radio and you know, a big cab. I mean, it was giant, right? And to see it in contrast to, you know, a Model G from 1953 or whatever it's kind of astonishing to see the difference from where we were to where we are.
Yeah, a lot of modern tech, you know, I'm not really up to speed on how it works, but I'm sure that a lot of it can be done, like, driverless now with satellite and GPS. Did you see any of that?
It exists. They didn't really talk about it. I mean, this was more of history, not about current
modern
technology.
Yeah.
And they had some engines and stuff in there, though not necessarily a lot of great detail about what's really going on there. But I do know, I have a friend of mine is retired now, and he's got a brother or an uncle or somebody that still runs a farm in Iowa. And so he'll often travel down there at planting time or harvest time to just sit in a tractor and help make it go. And he says it's, you know, the tractors that he uses have GPS on them to help keep the rows straight. And so his job is basically at the end of the row to turn the tractor around, and then the GPS locks in and
takes it the rest of the way.
Goes down to the end of the field the other way, and he turns it around and away it goes again. And I know that, you know, Caterpillar bulldozers and stuff have GPS on them to get them lined up and doing the right thing. So certainly there's a lot of technology that goes on in these things now. But it's still, you know, it brings out your little inner 8-year-old, right? Oh, giant tractors, right? It's kind of neat.
Yeah. Okay. I'll have to check it out. I actually pass through Waterloo
with some regularity.
Every once in a while, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's cool. I don't know. It's part of the, one of the things my girlfriend is particularly great about is asking the question, which is obvious in hindsight, but it never occurs to me. You know, we're driving on this route. What is interesting along the way? And I'm more focused on destination, right? And she's, you know, saying, you know, hey, are we going to have time to stop somewhere? Because riding in the car with you is boring.
Yeah. Oh, I wasn't going to go there, but I was going to say, we have to drive through Iowa. Is there any way that we can make this
right
more interesting?
Yeah, which is a good thing to do, right? Because, you know, it doesn't take that long, and maybe you'll learn something along the way. So, all right. we're getting towards the end. You got anything else?
No. I think I'm,
I think you're good.
I'm good.
Okay. Did you see how skillfully we did not talk about Apple and the FBI this week?
I did.
I'm sure next week.
Oh, we didn't talk about what movies we saw. I went and saw Cloverfield. Sounds like you were busy.
I was busy.
But
don't tell me anything about it.
I won't tell you anything about it.
Was it good?
Yeah. Okay. I liked it. Very interesting. It made a lot of money this weekend, too, which from the reports I heard was surprising. It was one of those overperforming movies, and I think it's because the original Cloverfield movie kind of had like a kind of a cult following to it. I think it got bigger and bigger as time went by.
Yeah, I remember that original Cloverfield movie, the advertisements for it were bizarre.
It was one of those movies that I think it was supposed to be kind of an experiment. Like, it might have totally fallen flat because it was kind of a different,
yeah,
different feel for a movie, different marketing. And then it, I remember when I went and saw it, I was expecting it to be terrible, and I just loved it. And I think that was the reaction a lot of people had. So I'm not sure why they weren't expecting a big opening, but nobody really was, and it was a successful movie.
No, I did not make it to the theater to see any movies this past week. I watched a movie on DVD. I put in Joe versus the Volcano the other day. I don't know if that counts as interesting or not, but I find that movie strangely fascinating.
Yeah.
Even, I mean, it's the movie's from 1990, right? So it's 26 years old now, right? With a young Tom Hanks and a young Meg Ryan in it three times. She plays three characters in that show. But,
oh, that's right.
But yeah, I don't know. Every 5 or 6 years, I seem to come back to that movie, put it in again, and just enjoy the how the luggage problem is solved.
Cool. Okay. Good enough.
All right. Talk to you later.
Bye.